I'm Jonathan Capehart, and this is a special Cape Up. This past weekend, we celebrated the birthday of America at a time when the history of America and its founding is being debated and denied, which is why we're bringing back the conversation I had with Ty Sigily. He's the retired Army Brigadier General and Professor Emeritus of History at West Point, whose compelling book, Robert E. Lee and Me, A Southerner's Reckoning with the Myth of the Lost Cause, is a great antidote to the anti-critical race theory hysteria gripping the Republican Party. After all, as Sigily reminds us,
this myth of the lost cause is still infecting our nation. It's in our DNA. You know, racism is the virus in the American dirt. It's our eternal pandemic. And until we are honest about it, we are never going to get over this.
Hear the rest of this compelling conversation right now. Ty Sigily, thank you so much for coming to the podcast.
Oh, Jonathan, my absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I found out about your book. Your book has been out for more than a year now, right?
No, it came out the end of January of this year.
Oh, the end of January this year, because I got an email from Ron Chernow, who is the Pulitzer Prize winning author of biographies on Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, the latest one, Grant. And he sent me an email and he said, You must read Robert E. Lee and Me by Ty Sigily. You have to read it. It is right up your alley. And I'm so glad he recommended it. And I'm so glad I read it because it truly is something I've been dying to read. And that is a white Southerner taking on race, racism, but most importantly, the myth of the lost cause. And so how about we just start right at the beginning? Who were you when you were a young kid growing up in Virginia? Who did you want to model your life after?
Jonathan, it's crazy to say it, but I wanted to be like Robert E. Lee. And I did. My first chapter book was about Robert E. Lee. My dad taught at a school in Northern Virginia where the descendants of Robert E. Lee were. He was the ultimate Virginia gentleman, an educated Christian gentleman. And everything in my life in Alexandria led me to believe that he was this great person. In fact, you know, it's like that old movie, Spinal Tap, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, I would have said Lee was an 11. You know, and even though I was a good Episcopalian, went to church every Sunday, I was a head acolyte later in high school, I would have put Jesus in the 4, 5, 6 range. So it wasn't as though that I saw Lee as good. It was reverential.
It was reverential because, as you write, it was all around you. The reverence for Robert E. Lee manifested itself in myriad ways. Talk about some of those.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there were streets named after Lee. There was his boyhood home, which was a shrine. There was a Confederate monument on Prince Street in Alexandria. At the school where my dad taught, there was a big marker where all the Confederates who died in the war were. But of course, there were U.S. soldiers too, but they weren't listed. Everything about it and the books. The textbooks I had as a kid, everything. In fact, I was happy in the sixth grade when we were finally integrating schools in Alexandria. I was bused across town from the white elementary school, Douglas MacArthur, to the segregated black school. And what was the name of that segregated black school? Robert E. Lee Elementary School.
As I was reading your book, the level of malevolence in terms of the naming and the creation of the myth, the nurturing of the myth, despite all the evidence to the contrary, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. So you write about this reverence, and you talk about how in Alexandria, where you grew up, there was one history that you thought you knew. And then come to find out that there was a whole other history of Alexandria that you then learned. And you go through in the book and you talk about all the places where you were, the history as celebrated by the community, and then the history as it really is. Talk about, start in Alexandria. what was the history that you grew up knowing? And then how did you learn the truth about Alexandria's history?
The analogy is we have this vine called kudzu. And if you've ever been in the South, it grows over everything. It covers everything. And the Lost Cause myth does that. And this Lost Cause that the war wasn't really about slavery, that a Reconstruction was an evil failure, that Black people, enslaved people, were actually happy to be slaves. This monstrous lies that created a system of white supremacy. And in Alexandria, what I didn't realize is that it actually used to be part of the District of Columbia, because George Washington demanded that it be part of Alexandria when Hamilton, Madison, and Jefferson created the idea of having a capital. And the reason it left in 1847 was to protect the slave trade. In fact, Alexandria was only in the Confederacy for less than 12 hours before it was occupied by the United States Army. I never knew that. And then all those Confederate names, the streets that were there, why were they there? They were named in the 1950s and 60s as a reaction to integration. So the more I learned about Alexandria, and then the heroes that I should have had, Lee was my hero, but my real hero is Samuel Tucker. Oh my gosh, what an amazing man. He grew up in the segregated Alexandria and then went to Howard. They couldn't find a law school, so he just took the exam and then started the first sit-in movement in Alexandria at the public library in the 1930s, served honorably in Italy as an officer in a segregated Black regiment, and then was one of the people that did Brown versus the Board of Education. I never heard of Samuel Tucker. He should have been my hero.
Then you move with your family down to Georgia.
Georgia, yep, Walton County, Georgia.
Your father became the headmaster of a small private school there.
Yes.
And so you were a student there.
I graduated from high school there.
Talk about Walton County, Georgia, as the history that you thought you knew.
Yeah, I thought I knew it. I had no idea. So I moved there in the summer in the 1970s, and I thought I knew it, but I went to a segregated academy, a Seggy academy, created that sprouted up like mushrooms in 1969 when they finally enforced integration. I went to one of those Seg academies. It was the sole purpose to ensure white kids didn't go to school with Black kids. That's number one. The second was I never knew about the tortured racial history of Monroe. Never heard about it. There is actually an 800-page book about the history of Walton County and Monroe that doesn't mention anything about that. Well, in Northern Virginia, there were 11 lynchings. In Walton County, there were 9. But the last mass lynching in American history was in 1946. I mean, this was 30 years after I moved there, and I never heard anything about it. No markers, nothing. Instead, there was a Confederate monument outside the courthouse. In this lynching, 4 Black people were trapped, ambushed, slaughtered, and they were never, no one was ever indicted. No one was ever found for that crime. One of them was a veteran. And I kept finding instances of veterans, Black veterans, being lynched in uniform. The moral degradation, the moral horror of that is just almost unspeakable.
You wrote early on in the book, the lies of the Lost Cause infused every aspect of my life, .. And that pisses me off.
It pisses me off, Jonathan, because I was infected with these racist lies. And I'm so mad at myself, at my own obtuseness for not finding it sooner. I'm upset because it created a society based on white supremacy, which is morally wrong. And it's not just morally wrong. Of course, it's economically stupid. So I was so upset that when I found this, and that's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about it now, is that I have to tell the world about this, because this myth of the Lost Cause is still infecting our nation. It's in our DNA. You know, racism is the virus in the American dirt. It's our eternal pandemic. And until we are honest about it, until we put the sunlight of history upon it, we are never going to get over this.
And we're going to talk more about that. But I want to keep going because I want people to understand your history, your background, so sure. that the passion that comes through really rings true for folks. So now you go to college and you go to Washington and Lee.
I go to Washington and Lee, Jonathan, to be an educated Virginia gentleman.
Right, to be a good, upstanding, white, Southern Christian gentleman, Virginian. Right.
White is everywhere in this. Everything I say, you got to put white before it.
Right. And so Washington is for George Washington.
Right.
Lee is for Robert E. Lee. in talking about Washington and Lee and briefly the history, please talk about the shrine.
This is the centerpiece of the university. And if you look, go inside it, it looks like an actual chapel, like a Christian church, except there's no Christian iconography in there. And it, what's in there instead is it's a shrine to Robert E. Lee. So, you know, you go up on the stage, there's no pulpit. There's no place where it lists hymnals, no cross. Instead, there is an apse, the sanctuary, which is the Holy of Holies. And, you know, where Christians put at the altar, and on the altar usually goes the Eucharist. I was Episcopalian acolyte. I know my way around a church. And so, but lying on that altar is not nothing. It's Robert E. Lee, the recumbent Lee. He's lying down on the battlefield in Confederate uniform with his hand over his heart and his left hand on the scabbard of his sword, ready to rise up for the people of the South. It's in white marble for the purity. That's the word that they would use, the purity of to fight for his social system of slavery. And so that is a monument. Downstairs is like a, it's a reliquary. His office, never been touched since the day he died 160 years ago. His horse, Traveler, buried right outside there. And they people come and put pennies on his grave, always face down, so that the hated Lincoln's face is not visible to Robert E. Lee, and so that Lincoln will have to kiss Traveler, Lee's horse, will have to kiss Traveler's I don't remember my graduation, but for my actual commission, I go into Lee Chapel and I go up on stage. I still have a picture of me right next to the picture of Robert E. Lee in Confederate uniform. I'm in my green uniform, about to be commissioned. He's looking resplendent. You know, the lights on him like a halo. You can almost hear the angels singing "Ah!" as it's looking at him. And then I go get my commission, and I get my commission next to this recumbent statue surrounded by Confederate flags. I get my U.S. Army commission surrounded by Confederate flags. I go back, sit in the aisle, raise my right hand, and take the oath of office to be in the United States Army. It's the same oath that everyone in the federal government takes. And when I take it, I say I will support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That oath was written in 1862. It's an anti-Confederate oath. When it says no purpose of evasion, anti-Confederate. So I took the oath to support the United States Constitution surrounded by enemy flags, Confederate flags.
Truly, truly incredible. So now, fast forward, you go into the Army, you serve all over the place. There are bases named after Confederate soldiers, people who fought against this country. You go through the book and you talk about each base. And okay, so Fort Hood, here's who this Hood person is. Here's who all these people are. And it truly is incredible to learn the history. I want to fast forward because I really want to get into now the myth of the Lost Cause. What is it? Who perpetuated it? And why does it still hold so much power, Ty?
Stories are more important and stronger than history. Stories are more important than facts. Culture trumps facts and history every time. And that's what I'm trying to do, is to tell a different story. But the Lost Cause myth is, imagine that the White South went to war to protect and expand slavery, to create a system that they were going to take into Latin America, the Caribbean, California, Mexico. And they, not only did they not win, they lost this slave system. The last thing they wanted was racial equality. And that's what they got with the 13th Amendment that created, that ended slavery, the 14th Amendment, the most important amendment, which created equal rights, the 15th Amendment that gave voting power. And so that they're completely lost. And so before the smoke clears on the battlefield, they have to come up with a new narrative to do this. And this new narrative is, one, the war wasn't about slavery. Well, that's just bull hockey. The war was totally fought for slavery. Two, that enslaved people were happy in their condition. That's just a horrific thing to say. Terrible. Three, the South could never have won this because the North had more manpower and materiel. Well, as a military guy, no. All they had to do was not lose. Fourth, that Ulysses S. Grant was a butcher and a drunk. No, finest soldier to ever wear U.S. Army blue. Reconstruction was a failure because Black people weren't ready for the vote. Well, this is another monstrous lie. 2,000 black men served. And at the top of the lost cause is the Christ figure, Lee. And but what we got to understand about this lost cause is it was the pillar along with black disenfranchisement, lynching, Confederate monuments. This is the spillers of a white supremacist society that was created in the South to keep white people in political power at the expense of black people.
That's just a tour de force explanation. And we've had conversations on this podcast about the myth of the lost cause with Mitch Landrieu, the former mayor of New Orleans.
Sure.
One of the things you also talk about here in your book is that the myth of the lost cause also sort of perpetuates itself because of the language that we use. One way is, so you say that the word plantation riles you. You're right, the word plantation riles me. What should a plantation be called, Ty?
Plantation makes you think of Tara and of Scarlett O'Hara and the wind whispering through the Spanish moss as Scarlett says, fiddle-dee-dee. They should be called enslaved labor farms because a plantation is a site of mass atrocities. It should be more comparable to Dachau than it is to Disneyland. And because that's what when I go visit one of those, I think about rape. Remember that the famous poet, I can't remember her name now, said that enslaved people have rape. She had rape colored skin. Sexual violence against enslaved women was ubiquitous. And so these places are horrible, and they rape, torture, and the worst, selling families apart for profit. I go on there and I hear the screams of human beings being tortured. So no plantation for me, enslaved labor farm.
You write about going to a wedding that was held at a quote unquote plantation that had been completely scrubbed of at least visible slaveholding past.
Literally whitewashed. And there was nothing there except in my own mind, it was the screams, it was the horror, it was the rape, it was the torture, but everything else was slave. There's only one of these so-called plantations that does an honest job. It's the Whitney Plantation in Louisiana, where the focus is on the majority of people that were there, which were the enslaved. And that's another word. Don't call them slaves, call them enslaved. They're not slaves. Somebody is forcing them to be enslaved. So I think the language that we use is really important. Like I call the South was a racial police state when I was born. I don't call Lee a general. He should be called a colonel. That was the last time he served honorably in the Army. So, yeah, I think that the language that we use has to change if we're going to see the monstrosity of the enslaved era.
You write towards the end of the book, and this also plays into the myth of the lost cause. You write, "Once I accepted that simple fact, the enslaved were people who deserved the same rights as any American, my whole thought process changed. I grew up thinking that before 1861, slaves were somehow not quite as human as white Southerners, that the enslaved only became real people after 1865. It pains me to write that I believed something so grotesque and immoral, but it's worse to lie."
That was the hardest sentence to write in the entire book, because I get almost teary when I think about that, because it was so monstrous to think that the enslaved weren't people. That's just not true. And that's part of what we as white Southerners grow up with, is that this was the right way. It wasn't all bad. It was all bad. It was deeply evil. And it is grotesque and immoral that I thought that. And anybody who thinks that there is any positive, so you often hear, oh, he was a good slave owner. Well, no, not good. If you're a slave owner, that's bad, morally repugnant.
So then what do you think, because then it gets complicated. With Robert E. Lee, as you write in the book, you show how he is just a truly horrible, horrible person. No horrible. Redeeming value whatsoever. But then when you get to slave owners like George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, who played enormous roles in creating this country that it remains a beacon of hope and freedom around the world, and yet they own slaves. How do we square that circle? Is it possible to revere someone so complicated or people so complicated?
For me, the bumper sticker for Lee is he committed treason to preserve slavery. So he was trying to create a country based on human enslavement. That was the only difference between the two. Washington was, that was not his primary goal, but he was an enslaver. So I think we have to take people, we have to, nobody gets a buy from history. And so we have to take Washington to task when he was doing that. And Jefferson, who raped, underage enslaved girls, definitely. I mean, even worse. But Washington also tried to figure out ways to keep his enslaved people when he was at the Philadelphia at the Constitutional Convention. So, yeah, we've got to be more open and honest about this. The thing is that we can handle this. We can find out that our founding fathers did great things and did horrible things. But the idea that those people who fought for the Confederacy, they did horrible things for horrible reasons to create a horrible country. So I do think that there's a difference, but we must be honest about our past. And it's not going to, it's going to make us stronger, not weaker.
You write about how Beauregard brought Eugene and Mary with him to New York, but he probably left Sally Hardin, another enslaved servant, back in Louisiana. Hardin had recently given birth to Beauregard's daughter, Susan. Enslaved women had no legal right to refuse sex with a slave owner, ever. We have a word for sex without consent, rape. You go on to write, and I don't have it noted here, but you talk about the fact about how evil it is, a system where men can rape enslaved women, have them give birth to their children, and then keep those children enslaved, and then even sell them.
I did my best to look at what it was like for enslaved people, but I wanted to think about what was it like for the slavers and the enslavers. And I just thought about that. I'm of an age, you know, I have two boys who are married and they're thinking about having kids. But I just thought about the fact that my grandkids, that I would sell them further south to these horrible conditions. I would not love my own grandkids. I would not love my own children, my nieces, my nephews. And it just, the stench of immorality, the level of evil that would have to happen for you to sell your own blood, your own children, is just, it's monstrous is the word I keep coming back to. I should figure out something else to say about it. But it's just so awful to think that they would sell their own children, to sell their own grandchildren. Oh, God, can you imagine that? We can't imagine what that's like. And we have given this idea of slavery a pass from our moral consciousness and where it should be in our frontal lobe. It should be right there in front of us.
And one of the things we do to not talk about slavery or talk about the war that was fought to end it is that we give the civil, not we, they give the Civil War different names. The War right. of Northern Aggression, the war between the states. I got a little confused. The War of the Rebellion, is that the good way of talking?
That's a good way. So in fact, in the 19th century, that was the official name of the war in the United States. So the great monument we have at West Point, Battle Monument, says this is fought, is to those who died in the War of the Rebellion. Because by saying rebellion, they don't get the status of being states. They're insurrectionists. They're seditionists. They're traitors. If you say war between the states, as what Jefferson Davis said, it's like France and Germany fighting. No, this is an insurrectionist force that would not accept the results of a democratic election and therefore chose armed rebellion instead. When you say, and you could also say what Frederick Douglass said, which I loved, which is the slaveholders' rebellion. I could go by that. Civil War is okay. The Southerners hated that. But I love War of the Rebellion. That, to me, it gets to the heart of it. And that's where the purpose of that war by 1863 is to free a race and weld a nation. And that's what the United States Army did, and including nearly 180,000 black soldiers whose story until the movie Glory was just completely forgotten. And that war was won by black soldiers and immigrant soldiers fighting in the blue uniform. And this is another thing. I don't use the term Union Army as though it fought only one war in its history. It's the United States Army, the same army I fought, the same blue uniform that George Washington picked, that Grant wore, that I wore for 36 years. So, yeah, it's the United States Army that whooped insurrectionist ass and saved the United States of America.
And yet, at the United States Military Academy, at West Point, there's Lee everything all over the campus. It wasn't like that in the, you know, way back when. It started sort of creeping up and creeping in to the spaces there at West Point. How did that happen?
Well, so this is really where I had my epiphany, and I'm going our barracks are named after our greatest heroes. So I go by Eisenhower Barracks, World War II, Pershing, World War I, Grant, Civil War, and I get to Lee Barracks. And I look at it and I go, you know, wait a minute. I'm living on Lee Road by Lee Gate in Lee Housing Area on West Point. I go and see this Lee Barracks and I go, why are all these things named after Lee? I race around campus and I find more than a dozen things named after Lee. I say, I understood Washington and Lee. Why in the hell are there this many things at West Point? Nobody could tell me. So I went into the archives as a good historian. And what I found was in the 19th century, West Point was an anti-Confederate monument. No Confederates in our cemetery, none on our monument, none in our memorial hall. So when did they come? The first thing of named after Lee is the 1930s. 1930s? What in the world? Well, it turns out that's when the first black cadet comes back in the 20th century, the famous Benjamin O. Davis Jr., the Tuskegee Airman, leader of the Red Tails. And he comes back in the 1930s. The next one is the 1950s, when the Army is fighting against integration, when Truman orders the integration in Executive Order 9981, and the Army's slow rolling it, another Confederate thing. That 1970, when minority admission starts, we go from a handful of black cadets to scores of black cadets. So Confederate memorialization at West Point, scratch it, and it's a reaction to integration. And all Confederate monuments are either to support white supremacy or, in another side of the coin, to fight against integration.
You sort of did that in a nutshell, just showing over and over and over again sort of the action and reaction. But, you know, there's a lot of politics at play here where you had presidents getting involved only because they're looking out for their own electoral futures, trying to win over Southern votes.
Right. Well, because remember, the South is a racial police state. The only way that black people can go into the courthouse is as defendants or custodians. And so by the time the 20th century rolls around, the black people have been completely disenfranchised in the South. And despite the fact that they're close or more than 50% in some Southern states, they have been completely excluded from the political process, reinforced by violence. And that means that the white senators and congressmen stay on these committees for years. They are the dominant political force. And so they have to be appeased to get anything passed. So that's why Social Security doesn't include domestics and farm workers. It's to purposefully exclude black people. In fact, I read the testimony of Howard W. Smith, congressman from Alexandria, who said, we can't give black people Social Security because if one 65-year-old black man has a pension, nobody else in the family will work. So you just keep finding these instances of just grotesque racism that cause much of where we are now. I mean, why does a great migration occur and all the black people leave the South? It's because of the economic and violence, lack of economic opportunities, education, and lynching that forced people to leave. So this is who our history is, and we've got to study this so we don't keep doing it.
In fact, you give a great nutshell of the history. And I'm not going to tell you where, because you need to read the book. Don't skip ahead. But you write, the Confederate States of America and those who fought for it refused to accept the results of a democratic election in 1860. They rebelled against the United States of America to set up a new country founded on the principle of white supremacy to protect and expand the institution of slavery forever. Then, when white Southerners lost, Lee and those who followed him created new ways to install racial control. Now that we can acknowledge the facts, our conversation can be grounded in reality, not myth and not ideology. An important point to remember is that we don't own the actions of people who lived in the 1860s or the 1930s, but we do have a responsibility to acknowledge the past, to acknowledge the facts. The past does not have to control us, especially if we understand it. Ty, that first part of that history that I read, particularly the part where the Confederate States of America and those who fought for it refused to accept the results of a democratic election in 1860. Throughout this book, I have seen parallels between then And now, where we're dealing with a political party that is refusing to accept the Democratic election of 2020. Do you see those parallels? And if so, how concerned are you about what that portends for the future?
Well, certainly on January 6th, like almost every American, I was shocked. I was shocked, but I wasn't surprised. I mean, I saw there are two things I saw. One is the Confederate flag in there, which I don't like to call the Confederate flag. I like to call it the flag of treason. I saw the flag of treason going in there, which was just monstrous. The second thing I saw was that that the gallows with the hangman's knot. And I thought, oh, my God, I've read about this. This is a lynch mob. I've seen these before. I mean, I haven't seen it, but I've read about these. I've studied them. This is an old-fashioned lynch mob incited by the president to go and kill Mike Pence, AOC, Nancy Pelosi. I mean, thank God nobody was found, because that's what this would have been. And to see that in that house, in the people's house, in the house I love, that I spent a majority of my life trying to defend, was a terrible sin on the country to see that. So, I mean, I think that this idea of democracy, the idea of equality, the idea of justice, we have to fight for it, because there's no way to have reconciliation without accountability and justice first. That's what we've got to have. And so I hope that they come up with some sort of 9/11 commission to go look at these things, to look at it. And I hope that we have a national commission that will look at our racial past to try to become better. I mean, we can do it. You know, I said previously, we Americans aren't made out of cotton candy. You know, we can handle the truth, but we have to ensure that we are studying this so that we don't have that happen. But at least nobody's talking about secession. I don't think, because the U.S. Army and the president, nobody's going to allow secession. I certainly hope.
Had you said this before the November election, I would have been like, Ty, I don't know. You might be a little hopeful there.
I know.
Given the way things turned out after the election, and certainly after the insurrection and the successful inauguration, we could breathe a sigh of relief that at least for now, things are fine. But I do wonder, how concerned are you that we're not out of the woods, that we're not out of danger?
No, we're not, because, I mean, we have to accept the results of democratic elections. I mean, that's the rule of law. We are based on the rule of law. And the thing that the Confederates did is they did not accept the rule of law. They would not accept the results of a democratic election. And that is the death knell of democracy, if you don't accept that. I mean, one of the things that Washington did give us was when he was commanding general of the Continental Army, he gave up command. One of the only people in that era, in the 18th century, that gave up the power to give it to Continental Congress. And then when he was president, he gave it up again. And we're the only country that's never had a military coup, or one of the very few, maybe there's another one, one of the very few that's never had a military coup. As a soldier, I'm extraordinarily proud of that role, that we've never had that. But it does take work to ensure that we have a system that will accept the results of democratic elections and has democratic elections. But I do believe in my country. I believe in this, that we can do this. But I do think that the foundation is understanding where we've been on this, because unless good people fight hard legally through the process, then you're right. We don't know what's going to happen. And this historian will tell you, man, you cannot predict the future.
You retired from West Point and from everything so you could write this book.
I could not write this on active duty, particularly under the Trump administration, because it was too hot for them. I love the Army. I love West Point. And it was too hot for them to handle at the time. Remember, in 2015, the Army put out this mamby-pamby excuse about, you know, this isn't about the names of the bases. This isn't about people who about the cause. It's about the people. Well, the people are terrible. So the Army and West Point just did not want to deal with this. I knew that. And the thing about being in the military is you don't have the First Amendment. And now I do. It's awesome. I'm really enjoying it. Really, really enjoying the ability to say these things and talk about it and try to convince some people, particularly people who look like me, middle-aged white guys, that there's another way of looking at this that will make us a stronger nation, a better nation.
What's been the reaction within the military to your book, what you've been saying?
overwhelmingly positive. The leaders I've talked to in the Army, the ones I've talked to, have been they're so excited. I mean, excited is probably the wrong word, but they want to work on this. They want a better Army, and a better Army doesn't, like at West Point, have things named after Lee. At the West Point, I know that they like what I'm saying too. They want to know the history, and they want me to help convince people about it. So yeah, I'm bullish about the Army. Remember, the Army is the most diverse organization in the country. And there are bases in the Army that are majority black troops that are a minority white. And so, you know, we have to get after this in the Army. And listen, we have problems with it. It's not as though we're perfect. We represent America, and America has problems with race. It's our, you know, it's our original problem. It's never, I mean, I may hope maybe it'll go away. It's certainly nowhere close to going away now. But the Army is working on it. But man, it has more work to do.
Do you know Secretary Austin?
I have met Secretary Austin once or twice. Huge fan of his, and you know, when people were arguing that we shouldn't have a Secretary of Defense who is a recently retired Army officer, I said, "Hey, Lee, you don't know Secretary Austin. I mean, he's getting after it. He did a stand down for extremism. He has started the first Office of Diversity for the Pentagon. I mean, he is a fantastic leader. I'd share a foxhole with him. He is a great leader."
We're going to have to end the conversation. Otherwise, we'll be here for like 3 hours because there's so much here to talk about. But I want to end by having you talk about something you did that the old version of you, young Ty Sigili, would have been appalled. And that was when you went back to your alma mater, to Washington and Lee, and you gave a speech, which was basically the template for your book, for this book. You went to, well, tell the story.
Well, it's the shrine of the lost cause. Remember, this is where Lee is. I was standing on top of his grave. Behind me was this white altar statue of him. One side is Lee in Confederate gray. The other side is Washington. And there at my alma mater, and again, I'm not some famous person at all. I told my alma mater that Lee chose treason to preserve slavery. And that's my bumper sticker, treason for slavery. And I went through, he violated the Constitution, Article 3, Section 3, which says levying war against the United States is treason. And why did he do this? Because he was the largest holder of enslaved people in the Army. By the way, he didn't have to do it. There were 8 U.S. Army colonels from Virginia. 7 of them remained loyal. Treason for slavery. And I had to say my truth. I mean, you knew I had to say my truth. But at the end of that, of calling Lee a traitor for slavery, to telling my school to end its romance with the lost cause, to do better, I thought, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? And what happened is that overwhelmingly white audience stood up and gave me a standing ovation. And I basked in the warm glow of acceptance at my alma mater. Of course, you know, one speech doesn't change an institution, nor does one book, nor does one podcast. But it did give me the hope that I could write a book that would be accepted by white Southerners because of the fantastic reception I got at Washington and Lee.
Well, there is one person who had a major impact, who in some ways changed history a little bit. And that is the woman who then became your wife, because she, I think it was on your first date or among your first dates.
Yes.
Where she, either she said this or you described yourself this way as not just Southern, aggressively Southern.
My wife, Sherry, is the hero of this book. She's the most honest person I've ever met. And it took her decades, but she got me there, or at least a little bit more there too. And she is. She's the one that looked at me like, you're Southern, man. Why is this so important to you? And she's also the one that went into Lee Chapel and said, she's raised a Catholic, and said, oh my God, Lee is the altar. Get me out of here. And she's also the one that supported it. She's the one that told me that, Ty, if you're going to change people's minds, you have to tell your own story. She understood, as I said earlier, stories are more important than history. And by telling my own story, by making myself vulnerable, by telling people that I was a racist, I was, that by saying that story that maybe I'll be able to convince more people that this lost cause myth, that this Lee idolatry, that the Confederates weren't just wrong, they were morally bankrupt, and that we must turn away from them and turn to the better parts of who the United States of America is. So yeah, my wife is the hero of this book. I would not have been able to write it without her love and her guidance.
And Ty, just personally, it is incredible for anybody to be raised with one worldview and then discover you see like a little crack in that worldview and you start picking at it and then the whole thing comes crashing down. The impact that has, certainly emotionally, on a person when that happens is pretty incredible. How has it been for you to just literally have your entire life change?
It's way better. It's way better, Jonathan, because, you know, once you see that the lie is there, it's like, I can't live that lie anymore. I cannot do it. It's too much. It's too wrong. And so once I started it, and the first time I gave a talk on it, I think that was the toughest part. I mean, I realized that this was wrong and I was going full tilt, but I didn't tell anybody about my own story. But when I told my own story, now I can't stop because, you know, the converts have the greatest zeal and I'm a convert to this, but it's a cause that it's both right and righteous. So, and the other part is I'd look at myself and say, listen, I'm a white dude who had all the privileges that, that went with a great education, a great army career, a great family. I'm not like it was like living under the enslaved era or Jim Crow I'm not living in a way that is any way threatening to me, which so many other people are. So I feel lucky to be who I am. And I'm also lucky to be an American where we can say these things and maybe we can just get a little bit better.
Ty Sigely, author of Robert E. Lee and Me, A Southerner's Reckoning with the Myth of the Lost Cause, former head of the history department at West Point, first professor emeritus of history at West Point. Thank you for coming to the podcast. And more importantly, thank you so much for this book.
Oh, Jonathan, it's been my pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me on here. I enjoyed our talk completely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Cape Up. Tune in every Tuesday. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. And how about doing me a huge favor? Subscribe, rate, and review us. I'm Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ.